Thank you all for coming, and thanks to Perimeter for nice hospitality. So yeah, today I would like to talk about the case for self-dual loop quantum gravity, which is this this idea that maybe we should and we could somehow revive these the old like complex Ashtekar variables for doing loop quantum gravity. And so the reason why I would like to do this is that I think there's a surprising sort of interplay between different problems that we have. Both in canonical loop quantum gravity and in spin foam models. And so some of these problems are, of course, the interpretation of this free parameter that we have, the Barbero-Emerzi parameter. And it's not really clear if this should be interpreted as a physically relevant parameter, so sort of a new fundamental length scale of quantum gravity, or if it should be seen as a regulator that should somehow be removed by some yet to be found process. And so, of course, this is also related to the question of what happens really to Lorentz symmetry in loop quantum gravity, because we sort of gauge fix the gauge group SL2C of Lorentzian gravity to SU2. And it's sort of like not really clear like what the effect of this will be on our fundamental theory of quantum gravity. And of course, this is also related to the issues that we have in spin foam models to implement the simplicity constraints, and also the problems that we have to deal with the canonical Hamiltonian constraints. Because you know that if you work with a real Emerzi parameter, you have this sort of problematic KOHK part in the Hamiltonian constraint. And finally, the last point, which is also very interesting, is that so far, when we derive the entropy of black holes in loop quantum gravity, for example, in the microcanonical approach, to get the celebrated Hawking formula that the entropy is proportional to area over 4, we have to fix the Barbero-Emerzi parameter to some real value. And so today I would like to argue and ask the question, can we look again at the self-dual theory, so the theory which is defined with gamma imaginary from a new point of view, and really try to see gamma as a regulator that should be removed somehow? And I will motivate a positive answer to this question by looking first at three-dimensional gravity and then looking at black holes in three and four-dimensional quantum gravity. And so the result that I will try to describe is first, just to give you a flavor of what is happening. And to remind you of what the problem is, I will talk about the Emerzi ambiguity in three-dimensional gravity. Then I will present the derivation of the entropy of a BTZ black hole from the point of view of state-sum models. Then I will talk about the entropy of four-dimensional black holes from the point of view of the self-dual theory and give some evidences for Hawking radiation. And then I will argue that there's, in fact, a unified framework if we take this point of view of taking the self-dual theory that sort of unifies the entropy of 3D black holes and the entropy of 4D black holes. Okay, so the first part is the BI ambiguity in three-dimensional gravity. And so the way to look at this ambiguity in 3D gravity is just to use a funny rewriting of three-dimensional gravity. So if you take, for example, Lorentzian 3D gravity, so in principle this is SU11 or SL2R BF theory, and what you can do is just sort of by hand extend the gauge group from SU11 to SL2C. And the way to do this essentially is to just introduce like this new vector ni, which is just a vector in R4 that enables you to completely extend the gauge group from SU11 to SL2C. So really by doing this, so the first action you see is sort of like a three-dimensional Lebesgue action because you have this BF term. Now you can use this gamma term because the group is now SL2C. So because it's SL2C, you have these two traces. You have one with the star and one without the star. So you can introduce this gamma term. And then you can put these simplicity constraints. And now if you impose with this simplicity constraint that the B field be simple, so in this 3D version, for a B field to be simple, it just means that B can be written as some vector times this triad. So really what this is just three-dimensional gravity with a gauge group embedded covariantly in a bigger gauge group. And this covariant embedding of the gauge group is just taken care of by this normal that we keep general so that we have sort of like gauge covariant expressions. And so why I claim that this is the analog of what happens in 4D is that if you look classically at these two actions, so this 3D Lebesgue action or at this 3D Holst action, you can see that on half shell, so when the torsion is vanishing, all the gamma dependent term disappears. So just like in four dimensions. And then what you can show is that if you do a spin foam quantization of this first action, so of this 3D Lebesgue action, if you impose properly like all of the simplicity constraints, so the primary and the secondary simplicity constraints, all the gamma dependency disappears and you get back to the Poinsettia regime model, which you expect because this is just three-dimensional gravity. So if you impose properly the constraints, you get back to Poinsenon-Rege. So this we showed in this paper with Karim Nouy, and then Sergei Alexandrov generalized this in four dimensions. Because in four dimensions, it turns out that this can be used to describe degenerate Plevansky theory. So now the question that I want to ask is, what about the canonical quantization of this three-dimensional host action? So this is what we did in this paper. And so now to answer this question, we have to sort of use an additional trick, which is to notice that there is a lot of gauge freedom in this action when it's written in this way, because we have this new normal that we have added. We have sort of extended the gauge group. So we have sort of a boost symmetry that appears. But what we want to describe really is 3D gravity. So we're only interested in SU2 flatness, for example, or SU11 flatness. So what we can do is sort of gauge fix like some of these fields in this action. What we could do is do the canonical analysis without gauge fixing anything. This would tell us like what the canonical structure is. But it's more convenient to just do a gauge fixing, because again, what we have in mind is to mimic what is done in 4D. And in 4D, we use this time gauge, which is gauge fixing from SL2C to SU2. So we can do the same thing here. So there is a first gauge to study, which is the SU11 gauge. And to obtain this gauge, you just fix this normal to have to be this vector. And then if you do the canonical analysis of this second action, of this Holst action in this gauge, you find that once you solve the second class constraints, what you get is SU11 BF. So this is why I call this gauge the SU11 gauge, because if you make this gauge choice, you do the Hamiltonian analysis, you end up with SU11 BF. And very importantly, you end up with a phase space which does not depend on gamma. So this is SU11 BF. We know how to quantize SU11 BF, and the quantization is evidently gamma independent. You start with a phase space that has no gamma dependency, you quantize it, none of the operators, nothing depends on gamma. Now what is even more interesting is that you can use this SU2 gauge fixing now. And to obtain this SU2 gauge fixing, you have to make this choice of this normal and of the triad fields. So this I would call is the 3D analog of the time gauge that we use in 4D. And now if you use this gauge fixing, you can see that the second action, this 3D Holst action, gives you in 3D the SU2 Ashtekar-Barbero formulation. So this is the analog for 3D gravity of the SU2 Ashtekar-Barbero formulation. So this is how you would write Lorentzian 3D gravity as an SU2 gauge theory, just like we do in 4D. Because in 4D, we write Lorentzian 4D gravity as an SU2 gauge theory. This is the way to do it in 3D. And you can see that the connection is an SU2 connection. It has this gamma part. It depends on the emergency parameter gamma. It has this K part. You have SU2 Gauss constraint, and you have these three Hamiltonian constraints, which you can combine because it's 3D gravity. So really, it's a flatness constraint if you want. But you have, again, this KOHK term. So now you can ask how to quantize this theory. So the first thing to observe is that if you do this SU2 gauge fixing, before doing that, let me point out that you see that already classically, whether the theory will depend or not on gamma is already like a statement about which gauge you use. Because if you use the SU11 gauge fixing, everything is gamma independent, already classically at the level of the phase space. And if you use the SU2 gauge, everything depends on gamma. So clearly, this tells you that, you start with a gauge group that is non-compact. If you fix to another non-compact subgroup, gamma disappears. And if you fix to a compact subgroup, gamma stays here. So it's sort of telling you that the presence of gamma is here to remind you of the fact that you started with a non-compact group and that you gauge fix to a compact group. Because you have to remember that, in fact, the only difference already in 4D between the Lorentzian and the Euclidean theory, once you gauge fix to SU2, is just a sign here in the Hamiltonian constraint. And this sign, you can keep track of this sign precisely because you have this gamma term. Now, if you look at the SU2 kinematics of this theory with the SU2 gauge fixing, you see immediately that the length operator, so the length spectrum, depends on gamma, just like the area operator depends on gamma in 4D. So you have this proportionality to gamma. And what you could try to do is say, OK, now I will compute the entropy of a 3D black hole and fix gamma to be a certain real value by requiring that I want to have the Hawking formula. So this we will talk about later. And now you could think about the quantization of this theory. So one first interesting thing to do, which we didn't do so far, but it would be interesting, is to really quantize this SU2 theory. Because I think that by doing so, you could sort of clarify the ambiguities that appear in the quantization of the 4D Hamiltonian constraint, just for the simple reason that this is now 3D gravity, so you know the solutions, you know the physical Hilbert space. So you could sort of try to do what was done in QSD 4, except that in QSD 4, it was done without Barbera-Emergency parameter. So it was done without this KOHK term in the Hamiltonian constraint. So this would be one potential thing to investigate. But now what you can do is, if you want to solve this SU2 theory, you could say, okay, now I don't want to solve this SU2 theory because the constraints are too complicated because of this KOHK term. So what you could do is try to map this SU2 theory back to a BF theory. So in some sense, you want to find new variables, A, and new electric fields, E, which give you these constraints, a flatness constraint and a Gauss constraint. But if you do this, you find automatically that if you want to have these constraints again of the BF type, you end up automatically with a complex connection again. Automatically, the connection that you work with is an SL2C connection. So you have these rotation generators and these boost generators. Okay, and the remark is just to tell you that even also here in 3D, you see appearing this connection that was introduced in 4D by Alexandrov, this so-called shifted connection. And here in 3D, if you compute the shifted connection, what you get is just the self-dual connection. So the SU2 connection with gamma equal to I. But now, okay, what is important is that now you have this SL2C connection. And it's a complex connection. So you have to impose reality conditions on this connection. Otherwise, you cannot quantize the theory. And in fact, you see that there are two possibilities for imposing reality conditions on this connection. Because this connection is SL2C, you could choose two sections of SL2C. You could choose the SU2 subgroup or the SU11 subgroup. And essentially, these two restrictions are given by these equations on the generators of the SU11 subgroup, the SU2 subgroup, and their complements in SL2C. So these are exactly the same constraints that appear, for example, in spinform models that were studied by Florian Conradi and Jeff Libida. So these constraints, you have, in fact, these two possibilities. And what happens if you use the first possibility? What you get, again, is an SU2 connection. And if you use the second possibility, what you do is you reduce the connection, which is SL2C, to an SU11 connection. And so the fact that here we are in a canonical theory and we have these spinform-like simplicity constraints that appear is not strange at all, in fact. It's the same thing that was shown by Wolfgang Wieland in 4 dimensions, which is that if you work with a real emergency parameter and you still do a self-dual, anti-self-dual decomposition of the theory, what you do effectively is you trade the reality conditions on the connection for linear simplicity conditions. So the same thing happens here. And what is funny now is now if you compute the geometric operators, the spectrum, using this SU11 connection, because you know that what you want to describe, in fact, is SU11 BF theory. What we did in the beginning is just take SU11 BF theory, embed it in SL2C, and then do a gauge fixing. So if you want to go back to the right physics, because you know that what you want to describe is SU11 BF, you have to use this constraint, work with this SU11 connection. And if you do this, there's a miracle consolation of the gamma-dependent terms, and you find that the length spectrum does not depend on gamma anymore. So this is completely consistent with the analysis that was done of the spectra of operators in 3D gravity by these three people. And in fact, you can see that in order to have like a real length spectrum, what you have to use is representations of SU11 that are in the continuous series, so for which the spins are written IS minus 1/2. So this is in complete like contrast with what you would obtain if you work with the SU2 connection. If you work with the SU2 connection, you have discrete spectra that depend on gamma. Whereas if you work with the SU11 connection, which is really what you should do because you're doing SU11 BF theory, then you get gamma independent spectra and you get continuous spectra. So if you think about like if the same thing happens in 4D, then it's sort of puzzling because in 4D we're saying that we do this gauge fixing, we have discrete and gamma dependent spectra, but maybe this depends really on the gauge fixing that we did. And in 3 dimensions, it's exactly what happens. This dependency on gamma of the spectra and the fact that they are discrete or not is a complete artifact of the gauge that you choose. If you have the compact gauge, it's discrete and gamma dependent, and if you have the non-compact gauge, it's continuous and gamma independent. So in fact, I still don't know what happens if you go ahead and try to quantize the SU2 theory, So I cannot answer the question of what happens to the discrete gamma-dependent kinematical operators if you try to quantize the Hamiltonian constraint and if you try to see what happens to the physical operators. I still don't know if these will be continuous and gamma-independent. But at least it shows you that there's the same connection ambiguity in this 3D model that you have in four dimensions. Okay. So now I want to go to the description of a BTZ black hole in three-dimensional gravity. And sort of see the link with what we just said about the emergency parameter and the self-dual theory. So just to summarize basic facts about 3D gravity and the BTZ black hole solutions. So you know that three-dimensional gravity looks extremely simple because it's a topological theory. And the reason is that in 3D, the Weyl tensor is identically vanishing. So you can rewrite the Riemann tensor with this in terms of the cosmological constant and the metric tensor. And in fact, all the solutions to 3D gravity are locally spaces of constant curvature. So it's either locally Minkowski, de Sitter, or anti-de Sitter, depending on the sign of the cosmological constant. So because of this, there's no local degrees of freedom, or no gravitational waves in the classical theory, no gravitons in the quantum theory. You could also see the fact that it's topological by looking at the number of variables and the constraints in the canonical theory. So anyway, all this is saying that the theory is topological. But even though it's topological, it's completely non-trivial, because even if a manifold has non-trivial topology, the global geometry of the manifold may be completely non-trivial. And this is what is important about 3D gravity. And this is the reason why, if you have a negative cosmological constant, because you can have highly non-trivial global topologies, you can in fact have black hole solutions. So this came as a really big surprise when these three gentlemen discovered the fact that 3D gravity, both Euclidean and Lorentzian, with a negative cosmological constant, has black hole solutions. Because this seems to contrast with the fact that it has no local degrees of freedom. So it has only topological degrees of freedom. And so this BTZ black hole solution, so here it's described for the Euclidean case. So as I said, it's a solution of 3D gravity with negative cosmological constant, which I rewrite in terms of this cosmological length squared. So you have this line element. And so, of course, this metric, this black hole solution, has no curvature singularity at the origin because the space is of constant curvature. But it has both an event horizon and an inner horizon in case you have non-vanishing angular momentum. And so what is amazing is that these 3D black holes, they have thermodynamical properties completely analogous to the solutions, to the 4D black hole solutions. And this is, again, quite mysterious, because if we think of these thermodynamical properties, like the entropy, as arising from a big number of microscopic degrees of freedom, we just said that 3D gravity is topological, so it's supposed to not have local degrees of freedom. So this is... But still lambda. Yeah, still lambda negative. Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly what happens here. But I will tell you in a minute why I want to take this configuration, because it's sort of the only one that I can treat with the state sum models. And then we can ask the question of how to go back to the Lorentzian solutions. And, but this I don't know how to answer so far. And so also this black hole solution was the first example of ADS CFT, because these solutions can be described by a boundary CFT. And so in fact, what is nice is that the geometry, the global geometry of a Euclidean BTZ black hole is that of a solid torus. So I just represent it like this, as this cylinder that you can imagine with these two disks identified. And you have a boundary, which is just a regular torus that is at chi equals pi over 2. And you have a horizon at the core of the solid torus. So you can really picture the Euclidean BTZ black hole as this solid torus where the horizon is the core of the torus. And now I want to motivate further the study that I'm going to do. And the motivation is that, in fact, the statistical mechanics of this BTZ solution has been extensively studied with tons of different methods. So you can see this review by Carlieb that will tell you what these different methods and approaches are. But however, so far, there is no loop quantum gravity or spin foam description of these solutions. And I think that the problem is that all the gauge groups that are involved in the BTZ black hole solution are, in fact, non-compact gauge groups. And this is a problem, because all we can do in loop quantum gravity, So in the canonical setup and in spin foams, we can only work conveniently if we have compact gauge groups. These black holes are defined for a negative cosmological constant. So these are the gauge groups involved in 3D gravity. So both in the Euclidean and in the Lorentzian theory, if you have a negative cosmological constant, you have either SO22 or the Lorentz group SO31. So in both cases, you have a non-compact group. So the idea is sort of to say that the only spin foam model that is well-defined, well, apart from the, you could say the Poinsot regi is well-defined, even though it's less better defined than the Turev-Viro model. But the spin foam model, which is under like good control, is the Turev-Viro model, so which is Euclidean gravity with positive cosmological constant, so for which the gauge group is SO4. Yeah. No, I agree. But even if you don't put the translation part, even if you don't do transimons, for example, if you wanted to do Lorentzian 3D gravity, it would be you have still have to deal with the non-compactness of. But for spin foams, for example, I don't know. You know, I don't have any Lorentzian spin foam model in 3D. Yeah, but I mean. Yeah, in any case, it's non-compact. And there are proposals, but they are divergent. And
but in the Euclidean case with lambda negative, there will be uq su2 with q real.
Yeah, but then q real is also the problem, because with q real, I don't know. Or maybe it's not a problem. Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that if I want to find like the easiest setup to work with in this picture, is to just do Euclidean lambda positive. Because then it's Turev-Viro, and it's the sort of the most well-defined one, and the one that we understood like that we understand the best. So that's the idea. In fact, the idea is to study Euclidean case lambda positive, to define sort of an observable with this Turev-Viro state sum, and then to sort of switch to a negative value of the cosmological constant. So I just want to give a proposal for doing this: computing an observable with lambda positive, and then going to lambda negative, and then we have to understand if this makes sense and compare this to other approaches. So yeah, that's the motivation. The Euclidean spin foam with lambda positive is well understood. And so I just want to briefly introduce the Turev-Viro model for those of you who might not know what it is. And so to construct this model, we have to choose an integer k. And with this integer k, we can define a root of unity q. We can define these quantum numbers. So for example, n with a bracket around. So defined in terms of q in this way. Can we write this conveniently in terms of signs? And then what we, as a gauge group, what we consider, so the group theoretical data is this deformation of the Lie algebra SU2, so UQ SU2, and the set of its unitary irreducible representation. So these are labeled by half integer spins, but what is very important is that there is an upper bound on these spins. So the spins have to be lower than k over 2, where k is this integer that we choose. And each dimension is 2j plus 1. And now, as a geometric data, what we need is, as usual, a triangulation of a 3D manifold. And this triangulation consists of tetrahedra, like triangles, these edges, and vertices. And then what we just have to do is to assign certain amplitudes to these elements of the triangulation. So to the vertices, we assign some weight that I call omega to the minus 2, which is the real number. Then to the edges, we assign this weight, omega j, which is constructed with this quantum dimension of the representation j. And to the tetrahedra, we assign these quantum 6j symbols. Then once you have assigned all this data to the triangulation, you can do what Turev and Viro did, in fact. So if the triangulation has no boundary, what you can define is this quantity z, so labeled by the manifold that you started with, some triangulation of the manifold. And why do I keep track of this triangulation? Because this quantity is here, is obviously dependent on the choice of triangulation. Because they have to like assign all these amplitudes and then take the product of all the vertex amplitude, the edge amplitudes, and the tetrahedron amplitudes. And now what I have to do is take the sum over all the spins. And the beauty is that this sum is finite because there is this upper bound on the spins and defines, in fact, a topological invariant. And now what we should discuss also, maybe in the end, is that if you want to extend this definition for the case in which the manifold has a boundary, we need sort of to modify this prescription. And there are two ways of doing so. And I think that this might be related to as I will say later, to the log corrections to the entropy of a BTZ black hole. So now I just want to ask quickly two questions, like why this is a topological invariant, and what does this know about 3D gravity? Because we just introduced this thing by hand, so we could wonder, like, why is this 3D gravity? And so the reason why this is topological invariant has to do with Packner moves. So these Packner moves, they relate triangulations of d-dimensional manifolds. So these elementary moves, for example, in two dimensions, we have triangles. And this is the example of the 2-2 move and the 1-3 move. And Packner tells you that we can, if we choose two different triangulations like this one and this one, I can do a finite number of these Packner moves to relate these triangulations. So here, for example, I just do a 1-3 move here. And then here I do a 2-2 move, and I go from this triangulation to this one. Then in 3D with tetrahedra, the same thing is true. We have these Packner moves on the tetrahedra. And essentially the idea behind the Turev-Viro model and also the Ponzano-Regge model is that the amplitudes that we assign to all these building blocks of the triangulation, they satisfy algebraic relations that in fact mimic these Packner moves. And so what do I mean by this is, for example, the 1-4 Packner moves, which is like represented like this. So we have one vertex sitting inside of this tetrahedron, so which in fact splits this big tetrahedron into 4 tetrahedron. If you replace these 4 tetrahedron by one big tetrahedron, this is represented algebraically by this relation between the quantum 6J symbols. So when we take this sum with these weights over the quantum 6J symbols, we get just one quantum 6J symbol, which is representing this tetrahedron. So this is the reason for which we said that the Turev-Viro model is a topological invariant. Okay. And now just very quickly, what is the link with three-dimensional gravity? So the link is, as we just have seen, this invariant encodes the symmetries of the classical theory because it computes a topological invariant. And the classical theory has only topological degrees of freedom. Now, if you give really a name to this integer k that we choose, in fact, this k comes from transimens theory and is the level of a transimens theory. And k can be written in terms of the cosmological length that we had and the Planck length in this way. And you can see that in the limit where the cosmological constant goes to 0, or equivalently when the level is large or where the deformation parameter q goes to 1, the deformation of the Lie algebra SU2 goes to simply SU2. And there is a sense in which we could say that the Turev-Viro model becomes the Ponzano-Regge model. And the Ponzano-Regge model, we know for sure that we can derive it from this first order action for gravity. Then you can also see the fact that we have this upper bound on the spins as an infrared cutoff that is introduced by the fact that we have a non-zero cosmological constant. And another like reason for which this is 3D gravity is that people have shown that the asymptotics large J of the quantum 6J symbols reproduces the Regge action with a cosmological constant. And now the last reason is that there is a link between the path integral of transimens theory with this Turev-Viro invariant. So this was shown by Turev and Virlizier. And the link is that the Turev-Viro invariant is just a square of this so-called Witten-Reshetikin Turev invariant. And so now what I want to do is use this model to describe a BTZ black hole. And so to do this, we need like a list of ingredients. And so the ingredients that I think we need to have this description of the BTZ black hole is first a proper notion of observable. Like how can we use this state sum model and tell the model that we want to compute a given observable? Then we need to find a discretization of the solid torus, because it's what we have in mind, is to apply the Turev-Viro model on this solid torus. And what we have to do is understand how to somehow return to the case of a negative cosmological constant, because we said that the Turev-Viro model is defined for a positive cosmological constant. But if lambda is positive, there are no black hole solutions. So what I want to do is compute something, like assuming that lambda is positive, and at the end of the day, once I have done my computation, go back to negative values of lambda. And hopefully this will have a rigorous meaning. So the notion of observable that we choose is just to take a graph which consists of a subset of n edges of the triangulation. So inside the triangulation, I can choose a certain number of edges of this triangulation. And then what I can define is take this assignment of amplitudes that we had and take the sum over the spins, except that I don't sum over the spins that are assigned to the graph gamma that I choose. So this defines, in fact, an object which I call Zn. So this n keeps track of the number of edges that I have and depends on this graph. What one can show is that this object, in fact, is triangulation independent, but not everywhere, because I have just fixed the graph and I'm not summing over these j's. So of course, it's only topological invariant or triangulation independent away from the graph gamma. And of course, the other property is that if we sum now, if we take this object and we sum over these spins that we left aside, what we get is the original invariant. This is going to be our notion of state sum observable. And of course, there is a relation between this notion of state sum observable with the usual observables of transcendence theory. So I think this formula was derived by Barrett, maybe, and some of his collaborators. So you can show that there is a relation between these observables and the transcendence observables. And this is just the Fourier transform, where the kernel is given by the Verlinde coefficients. So here it's more convenient just to compute these observables instead of computing the transcendence observable. So now I want to compute really this observable. So I said that the second ingredient that I need is a discretization of the solid torus. So if I imagine that this is my solid torus, so D2 times S1, what I'm just interested in, because I want to discretize the horizon, is to choose a discretization of the horizon in terms of these n edges. And I'm going to say that this is sort of a tessellation of the horizon, so representing a discrete horizon. So locally, it looks like this. You have this succession of edges labeled by spins. And here, I have just represented a tetrahedron around a set of edges. And so now to compute.
So what is the time again?
The would-be time is like rotation in this direction. Like there's an angle that if you slice the solid torus, there's like it's this angle going around. So now with this discretization, I can compute, in fact, the observable associated to this horizon. So I take a given triangulation of the solid torus. What I want is to compute the Turev-Virov invariant, but I don't want to sum over all the spins that are assigned to this graph. And what is amazing is that we can compute this explicitly. And so the way to compute it is to use recursively this, what I call this partial Packner 4-1 move. And why is it partial? Because what I do is I only sum over two spins. Because see, I have this tetrahedron here around these two edges. But here, these two edges, they belong to the discretized horizon. So with my definition of observable, I should not sum over these two edges. However, what I can do is sum over this edge here and this internal edge here. And if I do this, in fact, if I carry only half of the sum, it's sufficient to collapse these four tetrahedra into one tetrahedron, except that we are left with these additional factors that depend on the spins on which we didn't sum, on J1 and J2. And here, Y is this triangular delta. And now if I use this in my definition of the state sum observable for the horizon, I can use this formula a certain number of times and obtain sort of a recursion relation between the observable defined with one edge, sorry, with n edges, and the observable defined with n minus one edges. Because what this is doing is it's collapsing these horizon edges, J1 and J2, into one edge, for example, J6. So what I get is this recursion relation. And then if we push it to the end, we get this odd formula here. But in fact, this is not that strange, because this formula is a very well-known object. And what this formula is just the dimension, so capital N, of the transcendence Hilbert space, which is the invariant space between like the tensor product space of N spins of UQ of SU2. So you can understand this dimension. So it was derived. So there is like a nicer expression for this formula that I will write later on. And this was computed by Kaol Majumdar, and then it's also discussed in this paper. And you can understand sort of this dimension as being in the limit where the level is very large as just a product of the usual like dimension of the SU2 representation spaces. And now, as I said, like the third ingredient of the construction is to understand how to go back to a negative cosmological constant. So we did this computation. We end up with this transcendence dimension. And now what we want to do is go back to lambda negative. And so the way to do this is sort of natural here, because remember that there is a relationship between the level of transcendence theory and the cosmological constant. And it's the following one. So see that if I now switch from a positive cosmological constant to a negative one, this amounts to choosing a purely imaginary level, k that I call I lambda. And now if I do this, as I will show later on, for the moment I don't need this formula, but I just give you what the upshot of the calculation is. If we do this for k equals I lambda, this dimension of the Trin-Simons Hilbert space in the double scaling limit where the spins become large. So this is sort of the large spin limit like in spin-form models. And the Planck length goes to zero. We can show that the log of this dimension goes like L over 4 Planck lengths, where this length of the horizon is the sum of these microscopic lens contributions. And so you see that with this computation, there is no need to introduce a gamma parameter in this spectrum. Because there were, in fact, earlier on in 2008 and 1998, two attempts at computing the same observable and doing the derivation of the entropy of the BTZ black hole. But in these two papers, the analytic continuation to lambda negative was never done, in fact. In fact, the computation was based purely on the Poincaré-Regé model, which is already strange because Poincaré-Regé has no cosmological constant. So we cannot really talk about a black hole solution because we need a negative cosmological constant to be able to talk about a black hole solution. And also what they found is that in their computation, they don't get L over 4. They get L over 4 and some additional numerical constant. So what they said is that we could do, as in four-dimensional loop quantum gravity, introduce by hand an emergency parameter in the length spectrum, and then use this parameter to absorb whatever inconvenient coefficient we have in the entropy to get to the result L over 4, which is what we do, in fact, in four-dimensional loop quantum gravity. But here we see that if we do the calculation sort of, I say properly, even though I'm not sure this is a very proper and mathematically rigorous calculation, it's just a suggestion. But at least if you try to go back to a negative cosmological constant by doing this trick of continuing the level of Trin-Simons theory, what we get is the right entropy formula without having to introduce an emergency parameter. And even you see that if you wanted to introduce an emergency parameter, if we insisted on putting one in the length spectrum, the only result that would be consistent with this entropy would be gamma equals 1. But since this is Euclidean theory, gamma equals 1 is really the self-dual value of the emergency parameter in the Euclidean theory. So I will comment on this again later on, but okay, now I jump to.
So once you make the level purely imaginary, yeah. you still be working with the bounded speed.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So this can be like not natural from the point of view of Trin-Simons theory or from the state sum model, but from the formula that we have, it's what happens, yeah. So I don't know if this is like just a problem or not, or how this is to be understood. But yeah, it's what happens here.
Yeah. So you're talking about analytic continuation, you just mean the switch to imaginary level, that analytically continue.
Yeah. This to be more fancy that I say. But yes.
There is a model in 2 plus 1 which corresponds to negative cosmological constant, which amounts to a Q real.
Yeah.
And in order to have topological invariance, you have to have the sum not color.
Yeah.
So, why don't you even start from the model?
Yeah, so one interesting thing is would be to compare this to what would happen if we started with this. With this model, but then because we have like this unbounded sum, then I don't really know what happens. I'm not sure. Yeah, I agree, but maybe, you know, maybe I would get something divergent everywhere and I could not compute anything.
No, it's convergent because you have a Cauch. These sums are absolutely convergent.
Okay. So maybe it gives the same result, yeah. So indeed, it would be interesting to compare whether like a result that we get from starting with lambda positive and then going to lambda negative by doing this agrees with what we would get if we started immediately from something with lambda negative. Yeah, it's a good question.
You've done some cross graining before in the previous
slide. Yeah.
Right. So, Laurent, you're saying that the result of doing a cross graining with 2 plus 1 model is.
And you don't put a cutoff on the spin, then there's, you know, it's the political invariant. And
it causes
you. No, the sum is exponential for x.
Yeah, but it seems if I started with this, I would. So in fact, if I keep lambda positive, the story is like really tricky because, as you will see, like in the next slide, is what happens for the four-dimensional state counting. And if I want to, so if I wanted to extract like some sort of entropy from the formula with positive lambda, I would have to, I could not get it from just this dimension itself. I would have to do like a strange sum over spins, and so I don't know how to get the described cosmological. Because I don't know, in fact, how to get like a finite entropy if I do this thing. Maybe when we when I just. In fact, you will see the formula that I would obtain if I did this, just like in the next slide. Because in four dimensions, it's this formula that shows up. So yeah, let us go back to this maybe. Yes, now the last part is to see what happens in four-dimensional loop quantum gravity with black holes. And so in four dimensions, black holes, they're also described by Chern-Simons theory. So just like the tools that we use in 3D, but for a completely different reason, in fact. And the reason for which black holes are described by Chern-Simons in 4D is that the horizon symplectic structure, if you treat the horizon as a boundary in your spacetime, in fact, what you can compute is that the induced symplectic structure, if you write first order gravity in terms of the SU2 Ashtekar-Barbero connection, becomes that of SU2 Chern-Simons theory. So it's this term, SU2 Chern-Simons, with the level k, which is proportional to the area of the horizon and inversely proportional to the emergency parameter. And now again, for the same reason, like we know how to extract sort of things from this SU2 Chern-Simons theory, because SU2 Chern-Simons has been studied like extensively, for example, by Witten in the quantization of 3D gravity. We know that the path integral quantization gives relation to quantum groups and the quantization of the level. And in fact, the physical Hilbert space of this theory, which you can see as a sphere with n punctures, is just the space of invariant spins of uq of SU2. And this Hilbert space has finite dimension, and this dimension is given by this formula that I mentioned before that was computed by these two people. And now what happens usually in SU2 loop quantum gravity, the way the state counting works, is that we take this formula for the SU2 Chern-Simons Hilbert space dimension, and what we do is we now take a sum over all the possible punctures that are like describing the black hole. So we sum over all possible black hole configuration with any number of punctures. We sum over all the spins decorating these punctures, and we put a delta function that is enforcing that the sum of the microscopic contribution of the microscopic areas be equal to the macroscopic area of the black hole. And the first thing that is important is to notice that this sum is a sum over distinguishable punctures, because we sum here over like repeatedly over like same configurations. So this is a sum over distinguishable punctures. And then if you assume that this free parameter gamma that appears in the area spectrum is fixed to this value gamma zero, then you can get the entropy formula E over 4 with these log corrections of minus 3/2. And also what you have is a small spin domination. So this thing, this behavior, this entropy is completely dominated by small spins. And so you could ask the question of why we have to sort of assume that the spins, that the punctures are distinguishable, because if you have to think of these as being sort of excitations of the gravitational field, I don't see why they should be distinguishable and not indistinguishable. Also, we can question why we have to fix this parameter to this value, and why we also have small spin domination. Yes?
Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I do right now, in fact. So I don't get the right entropy, but I get the right entropy if I take gamma to be complex, in fact. So if I jump now, yeah. So as you said, if I don't do the sum over the punctures and the sum over the spins, if I just take the dimension of the SU2 trans-Simons Hilbert space, and I continue it just in the same way as we did for the three-dimensional case, so I take k the level to be I lambda, then this in principle should correspond to doing SL2C trans-Simons theory, although for the moment I'm not sure like how this compares really. But then if you do this, you can see that the partition function, so I already jump ahead of myself and call this the partition function, even though it's just the dimension of some Hilbert space, becomes this thing. And now there is no more oscillation. The asymptotics of this is straightforward. And it's funny because this is the exact same object that we obtained with the BTZ black hole in the Tura-Viro context, except that now we obtain it for a totally different reason. In 3D, we obtained this formula. I didn't write it explicitly earlier, but I said that this is what we obtained. We obtained it because we did a continuation of the level in order to go back to the case of a negative cosmological constant. Here we get this formula for another reason, because we continue the level, because the level depends on the emergency parameter. So if I take the emergency parameter to be imaginary, I have to take the level to be imaginary. And this is what I... Sorry? Well, maybe if it's a cosmological horizon, I don't know what happens. But if it's an isolated horizon, okay. And then again, for the same reason as before, in the limit of large spins, which is to be contrasted with the fact that before, in the usual state counting, you have small spin domination. Here, to get the entropy out of this, I have to take large spins, which sort of corresponds to the asymptotics that we use in spin foam models. Then I get this entropy formula. And here, what we can do is we don't have to assume that the punctures are distinguishable. This can be done with punctures that are indistinguishable. And like two other like facts that sort of support this idea of going back to a complex emergency parameter is that, so as was studied by Daniele Pranzetti, the case gamma equals I is also supported in favor if you want to give a KMS interpretation of the states that we're counting. And also what is very interesting is that if you did a loop quantum gravity in the constant mean curvature gauge, in fact, these people show that it's impossible to fix gamma to a real value because there is some parameter to absorb in the entropy. And this parameter depends on the mass of the black hole. So for this reason, it's completely like unrealistic, unreasonable to absorb these additional factors that we get in the entropy by fixing gamma. But what they notice is that if we choose gamma to be imaginary, then this problem completely disappears, and we get the correct entropy. So this is why I'm saying that in the CMC gauge, it's not even possible to fix gamma to a real value. And now another alternative that I want to mention, though this deserves to be like studied more, is that one could also forget about the level, because people have argued that the dependency of the level of SU2 trans-Simons theory on the emergency parameter for isolated horizon is sort of artificial. We can sort of reabsorb it and have a level that doesn't have the same dependency on the emergency parameter. But what is interesting is that there are certain representations of SL2C that appear if you write SL2C representation in terms of the SU11 subgroup. And it turns out that representations of the continuous series, we can call them in a precise sense self-dual. So they satisfy this self-dual constraint, where P is the generator of boost and L the generator of rotation. And the representations that are in the continuous series that are labeled by a spin, which is IS minus 1/2, they satisfy the area reality condition. So in this sense, that the area spectrum that we get is real, in fact, is not imaginary. We will get an imaginary area spectrum if you work with the usual SU2 representations in SL2C and not with the continuous SU11. And what is interesting is that if we take, again, the formula for the dimension of the SU2 trans-Simons Hilbert space, and instead of doing the continuation on the level k, if I just do this replacement of the spins, I get this expression again for z, in fact. So I can derive the same behavior and the same entropy by forgetting about the dependency of the level on the emergency parameter, but by doing this continuation on the spins. And this representation, they are self-dual in this sense, and they satisfy the area reality condition. And so now, if I want to go further and be even more speculative, what happens is that if you rewrite this sort of continued partition function that we wrote, when the level is large, we can rewrite this partition function as this product of these partition functions ze, and these appear as being like partition function for like particles that are thermalized at Unruh temperature, so inverse temperature 2 pi over a, where a is the acceleration, and the energy spectrum that we get is this acceleration and this like sort of vacuum energy proportional to the spin. And what is interesting is that this matches exactly this energy that appears, the near horizon energy that was derived by Froden, Gosch, and Perez in this paper, which is the energy seen by a local observer, a stationary observer, which is close to the black hole and accelerating with acceleration a in order to keep its constant distance from the horizon. So the exact same energy appears here. And we can further rewrite this partition function in this form by putting all this area-dependent coefficient in this degeneracy coefficient. You can see that you have sort of this energy here, this inverse Unruh temperature, and the degeneracy GE that appears here is assigned to each puncture. So each puncture carries already a sort of a degeneracy, which is exponential of the area carried by the spin divided by 4LP squared. And so this was studied in this paper also, like putting this degeneracy on the puncture of the black holes. And then you can also show that you get the entropy A over 4 without having to fix the emergency parameter to a real value. And now the last point that I want to make is that we can take yet another point of view on this self-dual theory, is if you write a state using a self-dual decomposition. And to get to this self-dual decomposition, what we can do is consider these anti-self-dual or self-dual generators of SL2C, which is just this complex linear combination of the boosts and the rotation, and then switch to the so-called helicity or unitary spinner basis. And this basis is labeled by these two complex spins, L plus and L minus. And in this basis, in fact, it's convenient because L3 and P3, where L are the rotation and P the boosts, they are diagonal, in fact. So we have these sort of properties of this basis. And one can compute the overlap coefficient or the change of basis, in fact. So going from the usual basis of SL2C to this helicity basis, this unitary spinner basis. So we can compute these overlap coefficients. And now, according to like what spin foam dynamics tells us, if you have like a state that is like decorating like a face of the black hole, depending on which spin foam model we consider, for example, the EPRL or the Barrett-Train model, this means that we have a certain restriction on the labels of the SL2C representation, which is given by this, for example, for the EPRL model, where gamma is the emergency parameter, and given by this for the Barrett-Train model. Now it turns out that if I use this representation in this formula for the overlap coefficient, taking me from the usual basis of SL2C to the helicity basis, now this overlap coefficient, they simplify dramatically. They take this very simple expression, which is like way, way simpler than like the bare overlap coefficients. And now if I compute this density matrix with these two states that I call like the spin foam states, and I trace over half of this unitary, of this helicity basis. So I trace over, say, the anti-self-dual part to get the self-dual part. What we get is in the large new limit. So the asymptotics is also given in this paper where the overlap coefficients are computed. What we get, what we see is that this state is a thermal state at Unruh temperature. And the energy of the quantum horizon, as measured by an accelerated observer, coincides, in fact, with the generator of the boost. And in the helicity basis, this nu is the eigenvalue of this boost. And this, if you remember, is exactly analogous to the derivation that was done by Eugenio Bianchi. So he did this paper, which is called Entropy of Non-Extremal Black Hole from Loop Quantum Gravity. And it's exactly this point of view, except that he derived this thermal state at Unruh temperature by looking, in fact, at the thermalization of a two-level detector. So he used this as a thermometer. And then he asked the question of what happens to a like an observer in his Rindler wedge, so an accelerated observer. And in fact, it turns out that for this observer, the Hamiltonian, which is generating the time evolution of this observer in Rindler space, coincides, in fact, with the generators of the boost. So what I would like to say is maybe here it's tempting to identify this computation, which is sort of the same one that the one that was done by Bianchi, but done in another context, because here I don't consider a two-level detector, I don't consider a thermometer, I don't look at how this system thermalizes, I just look at a density matrix and I trace over one half of this density matrix, which corresponds to the anti-self-dual part, and I get a thermal state. So maybe here it's tempting to identify this decomposition with sort of a quantum gravity analog of a left and right Rindler wedge decomposition. Then I trace over one of the half, and I get a thermal state. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm not. I think like the Lorentz group has like an independent action on these two. We can think of them as being decoupled in some sense. So if you think that, but because this is what this is doing is describing really what a Rindler observer sees. This is the exact same setup as the one that was describing Eugenio. Well, that's sort of the assumption here. Because if I want to ask the question, what if the fundamental like degrees of freedom of quantum gravity are described by either self-dual or anti-self-dual decomposition, I can do like for any state this general decomposition in the helicity basis, and then I have a canonical prescription for separating the states into self-dual and anti-self-dual parts. Yeah. And it just turns out that if I trace over one half, what I get is a thermal state.
That decomposition has nothing to do with the space decomposition left or right.
Yeah, a priori I agree, yeah. But yeah. So sort of to conclude, what we have seen is that in three-dimensional gravity, there is indeed a formulation of the Lorentzian formulation of 3D gravity in terms of SU2 variables. And this formulation has the exact same Barbera-Emerzi ambiguity and connection ambiguity as in four dimensions. What we saw also is that it may be possible to derive the entropy of a BTZ black hole by starting from the Turev-Vero model, which is again Euclidean and defined for lambda positive. And what we saw is that there is no need to introduce a Barbera-Emerzi parameter in order to get this entropy. So now, still the open question is like maybe we should also proceed with the quantization of the SU2 Hamiltonian constraints for the Lorentzian theory to maybe investigate the quantization ambiguities of the Hamiltonian constraints. What we should also do is try to describe now a Lorentzian solution instead of doing a Euclidean solution. We should find also is maybe if there are links with other counting methods, so in particular the one that is the most developed, which is using CFT techniques. What we should also see would be interesting is to see how to treat the boundary of the state submodel. Because as I said, to define the Turev-Vero model on a manifold with boundary, we have to be like sort of more specific and say what happens to the boundary, how with what type of data we label the boundary. And there are two choices for doing so. And I think that one of these choices may be related to the way in which we obtain log corrections. Because in fact, in the derivation of the entropy of a BTZ black hole in the Euclidean case, using the path integral, people have shown that you have to impose a certain modular invariance on the boundary of the solid torus in order to get the log corrections of -3/2. And it might be that this modular invariance of the torus in the continuum theory is reflected in a discrete theory by a specific treatment of the boundary of the state submodel. So this would be something to investigate. And now for the 4D theory, maybe we can just make more rigorous this treatment of the Barbera-Emerzi parameter as being complex, and maybe this idea of seeing it as a regulator that we can use to start sort of the quantization, and then at the end of the day, go back to the complex value gamma equals I. Then we should also clarify what exactly is the nature, once we do this continuation from gamma real to gamma to I, what is the nature of the representations that appear in the dimension for the Trans-Simons-Hilbert space formula? Because if you come from the SU2 theory, these representations are SU2 representations. But now if I take gamma to be imaginary, and if I think of this as being like what takes me back to SL2C, then if I'm doing SL2C, maybe I cannot think of these representations as being representations of SU2 anymore. So maybe you should understand really what type of representation appear in this formula. And what we could also do, and what we have started, in fact, is to try to write the four-dimensional theory in a gauge which is with the subgroup SU11. Because what we do usually is we start with SL2C, the Holstaction, for example. We use the time gauge that takes us to SU2, and we have all this dependency on the Barbera-Emerzi parameter. What we could also do is not choose SU2 as a subgroup, to fix the gauge, but use SU11. Because as we saw in three dimensions, if you use this SU11 gauge, what we get is SU11BF, and everything does not depend on gamma. So it's still an open question in 4D, what happens if you use an SU11 gauge? And I'm done. That's it. Thank you. Yes, it was just. Yes, so these observables. Yes, so I don't really know if I should call these kinematical or physical in some sense. Maybe. I would say they are physical because you can compute these, for example, in the Chern-Simons picture. You could, for example, take Chern-Simons path integral and put like an observable, like a Wilson loop, and you get like a physical result. That's the, it's, you compute this with the physical scalar product.
Here you just put the
yeah, exactly. This observable here is just like a, yeah, it's a series of like edges inside the solid torus. Yeah, and then I say that the sum of all these pins is equal to the certain length. And so in fact, the entropy of this is length over 4. So this, of course, might not be the entropy of a black hole horizon. This can be the entropy of any like circle that's in the solid torus. But I mean, then I'm taking the point of view that I have a solution which has the same topology as the BTZ solution, and that has a negative cosmological constant. So hopefully, there is a sense in which this indeed describes a BTZ black hole. The same thing is true in four-dimensional counting, like recounting the entropy of something. Like, it can be just, yeah, but it could be just, why is it really a horizon? You can just see this as the entropy of a surface, but at least it's not completely clear to me. Like,